Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm Tony Black, your host, and we're mixing it up again this week, and we're doing something slightly different because we're moving away from an episode, and we're not doing an interview, and we're not talking about brand new episodes of The X-Files, sadly, but we're going to talk about a book. The first original book that was written to tie in with The X-Files, and that's called Goblins. And I'm delighted to be joined by a writer herself and one of the X-Cast blog team for her first time on the show, Sarah Blair. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. I'm so happy to be here with you, Tony.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. and we'll talk more about this later, but you're a writer, aren't you, as well? You've got a book out.
I do. It's called Darkness Shifting, and there's a little bit of some X-Files influence that went into it, so I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun to talk about that later on in the show. And Sarah does write for the X-Cast blog, and you'll be seeing more stuff from her on there if you're following the blog on WordPress, which of course you are. Why would you not be if you're listening to this? They're obviously reading what we do, Sarah.
Obviously.
Obviously. We've just got to assume that, aren't we?
Is that a good thing? I hope.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed, yeah.
Our ramblings, amusing.
X-Files-based ramblings, yes.
Exactly.
That's what we all came together for, and we got a nice little group of bloggers who spend a lot of time on Slack talking rubbish, don't we? In fact, we spend more time on there talking rubbish than we do actually blogging, don't we?
Yes. if we took all of our energy that we spent talking rubbish, you know, we'd have plenty more blogs out and articles to write about.
It's true. Yeah. We'd probably have written a book by now.
Probably.
So before we talk goblins, we're going to do, for every new guest like we do, we're going to do the five questions of X for you, Sarah. So this will give people a little bit of a gauge of your X-Files fandom, because you're a big X-File. So let's start off by asking you then, when did you first discover the X-Files?
It was when I was in middle school. There were whisperings and everything when it first came out. All these kids were talking about this show called The X-Files. Did you see that show? It's so weird. And it's aliens and government and all this stuff. And I was like, ugh, that sounds so boring. Like, who would want to watch that, you know? And I, you know, in the back of my mind, I was a little bit intrigued. But, you know, I, back then in high school and middle school, I was, you know, whatever anybody was doing, I wanted to do the opposite. If it was, you know, a popular group thing, I was like, I don't want any part of that.
You're a rebel.
So I was. So, yeah. And then I started, I actually saw the first episode I saw was the Kalasari.
Ah.
And my friend called me, and it was late on a Friday night, like 9:15, I think. She called me. It was a dark and stormy night. She said, Sarah, I'm watching the X-Files, and my mom is out, and I'm so scared. Please talk to me. Turn on this show and watch it with me. And so I said, all right. So I turned it on, and we sat there on the phone just so scared together. I was like, what is this show? This show is amazing. I need to watch more of this. And so, yeah, I finally got hooked, and I kept it secret for a little while, but after that I became the biggest fan ever. And you know, I kept watching long after it was not popular to watch anymore. Everybody's like, oh, we're done with that show. Mm. It's boring out. I'm like, aliens, Mark and Sally for life. So yeah, needless to say, I was hopelessly hooked.
you were there through the days of the super soldiers, the days that only the hardcore X-Files fans really watched.
You stuck
with it, like me, like a lot of the people, yeah.
Yes. I even, sadly enough, tried to have an X-Files party one time, and only one person came.
Oh.
For the episode of Home, no less.
Well, more fool everybody, because that's an amazing episode. So the people who didn't come are the losers there.
Yeah, so it was just Definitely. Me and this one other kid sitting there watching this horrific episode thinking, what in the world is this?
I do like the fact that your whole fandom basically started, though, because somebody didn't want to be terrified by the show and rang you up and said, watch it with me. And that's a great way to start.
And she was in my wedding, so, you know, we're still friends.
That's really good. Well, I don't know if the Kalasari is the answer to my next question, but What would you say your favorite episode of the show is?
Without a doubt, I would, and I have to classify this as the one episode I could watch over and over and over again and still want to watch it one more time. I have a lot of episodes I would say are favorites, but this is the one that I really could probably watch forever if I could choose one episode, and it's Quagmire.
Yep. I knew you were going to say that.
I don't know how you possibly could have guessed that.
So what is it about Quagmire then?
I think mostly it's just, it's kind of a fun episode. It's not too serious. I like those episodes that have a little bit of the humor in them. And most of all, I really like that it's got a reasonable explanation for something fantastic, but you also are left wondering at the very end of, you know, wow, maybe they just, maybe the truth is out there.
Yeah.
Just have to keep on looking for it. Plus, you know, being a shipper, that conversation on the rock is just everything.
Yeah, definitely. It's got something for every fan there. Like you say, it's got a bit of the comedy. It's got those Mulder and Scully moments. It's got that great moment at the end with Big Blue, and you're like, oh yeah.
It's the one episode I can think of that's got just a little bit of everything for everybody. So yeah.
It's a really good choice. Quagmire's great. Great fun. and it's got, and I think it's got one of the highest body counts in any X-File.
Does it? I never noticed that.
I don't know that for sure, but the amount of people who get eaten in that episode is off the scale.
I mean, even, well, with the one, the Red and the Black, where they burn all those people on the bridge.
Oh, yeah, maybe that wins.
Maybe that wins. But, yeah, as far as, you know, Monsters of the Week go, probably. Yeah,
I think it's up there. We'll figure that out, Sarah, when we get to Quagmire, and we'll see.
Right. If we can talk about this.
So, obviously, Quagmire's in season 3. Would that be your favorite season? What is your favorite season of the X-Files?
I've been thinking and trying to decide between 3 and 4.
Yeah.
And it's a tough choice.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know. Like, could I just pick both? Is that cheating?
I can't decide.
Like, even 5 is great.
Yeah.
Small potatoes and, like, all those. So maybe I'll just go in the middle and say 4.
I think that's a good answer. I think, and you know, a lot of people, when they come on this show, they tend to say 4. A lot of people say 3 or 4.
On this, I'm going to have to join the bandwagon and go with 4, yeah.
Yeah, there's a reason why there's a bandwagon, definitely, because it's a great, great season. It's got some amazing episodes. And yeah, it's hard to beat, really. It's probably mine, either that or 2 for me, but, you know.
Yeah.
If people want to know more about that, check out the episode, The X Primer, right at the very beginning, because that's when I do my 5 questions of X. I won't bore you with it now. But yeah. So if that's your favourite season, we've got your favourite episode. Who is your favourite character? Now, this doesn't just have to be Mulder and Scully. Could be anybody. But who would you say yours is?
Hands down, Skinner.
Skinner, yeah.
Yes. He is, like, so, in my humble opinion, he is the most underrated for lots of reasons. I can't wait to write my Skinner blog for the show or for the blog. I'm so excited about that. Like, every time I watch a Skinner episode, I just get so excited because there's so much going on with him that we don't get to see. And it's just, I want him to have his own spinoff show. There's so much untapped material with him.
Yeah.
You know, you can't go wrong with Skinner. He's got something there.
I think you could do a really hard-boiled action show with Skinner.
Like, oh, for sure.
Do you know what I mean? Like where he's like, maybe he gets demoted from deputy director and he has to, or assistant director, and he has to be like, you know, a bounty hunter or something. You just send him out on the road, traveling America, fighting demons. Like Supernatural, basically, but with, and I know he's in Supernatural, Mitch Pileggi, but just have Skinner. Like, be that, you know.
I mean, I'm not gonna like beat around the bush. That's kind of what I had in mind when I wrote my book. Like, this is Skinner after he retires. This is my, in my own imagination, this is what happens and what becomes of him. So yeah.
We're on the same page there, definitely. Excellent. Skinner's a great, you know, Skinner doesn't get said enough for this. When I ask this question, understandably, quite a lot of people either say Mulder or Scully, and I completely get that. And you get some people say Mr. X, or some people say the Smoky Man, or whatever. But not many people say Skinner, and he is brilliant. Yeah. You know, he would, the show wouldn't be the same without him.
Exactly. I mean, he toes that line, you know, right between the truth and not. And he helps Mulder and Scully, but it's sometimes, you know, he helps them by interfering with them. You know what I mean? Like he knows more than he lets on. And, you know, like sometimes he has to hinder them in order to hold them back to keep them alive. Basically, like he's like, you guys can't be doing this right now. You gotta take it easy. And he has to pull them back, you know, especially I was watching Triangle recently, and he does that like really, like that episode really, you know, there's so much going on with him when he, you know, he tells Scully, like, you don't know what you're doing here. You need to, and she gets so mad at him because she thinks he's trying to not help her. Really, he is. He's
And
like,
then you get that moment where he gives her what she needs in the lift. She gives him that big sloppy kiss, and then she walks out the lift, and he goes, "If you do that again, Agent Scully, I will have you written up, wrapped up, and tossed out of the FBI." And he's
Exactly.
totally doing it just for, you
Yeah.
know, just
It's
for
all
show.
show.
I
Yeah,
love him. I love that. And she's like, "I get it, I understand," and she runs off with the lone gunman. Brilliant.
It's
Ah,
a great
Triangle.
episode.
It's a great episode. We're going to have some fun with that when we get there on the X-Cast. It's a great episode. But we were a long way off from that, folks. Sorry to disappoint you. But we will get there. So, finally then, if you had a favorite moment from the series, what would it be, Sarah?
I like the shippy moments, obviously. You know, the two that jump out to mind right away are the, you know, the conversation on the rock and Quagmire, and the when they're out in the middle of the Everglades, you know, in the sleeping bag, and she sees him.
Vitor,
Sort of, yeah, that's a great one. Yeah, that's really, I like those. And I mean, there's so many more. And then oh, the one in Dreamland 2, when they're essentially saying goodbye forever, and she's like, I'd kiss you if you weren't so dang ugly. Like, I mean, like, really, you watch it, and they don't know that they're gonna ever get fixed. I mean, at that point, they don't know what's gonna happen, and they're essentially saying goodbye, like, I'll never see you again. Like, that really gets to me every time, because it's just like, you know, it's a humorous episode, and you know, everything eventually does get back to normal and everything, but just in that one moment, it's like pretty intense.
Because they do play it for real, don't they? You know, they do play it as if this is it. They're never gonna, you know, we know it's gonna happen. But I think one, if I was to pick a little shipper moment, it's probably the, I quite like, thinking of season six, I quite like the ending of How the Ghost Stole Christmas, when they just open presents together, and she does this little lovely little smile when he gives her a present, and she just runs and sits down, and when the camera pulls away from his apartment, and they're just opening presents. It's lovely. It's a lovely little, there's lots of those little moments in season six, you know, which makes sense because they were heading towards becoming, you know, a couple.
It's fun to watch those moments, just when they're getting to be, you know, themselves and not having to deal with all the crazy conspiracy stuff. Yeah, those little moments that we, you know, we didn't get many of those, because, you know, but I guess that's what makes them so special.
And obviously we get less of them in the revival series. Except maybe the ending of Babylon is one of the most shippy moments, possibly. But that's probably the only thing about Babylon that I can bear. But let's not go there.
That
It's a touchy subject. So okay, that's the five questions of X. We've got a good look at your fandom there, Sarah. So that's excellent. Your love for Skinner, rock on. I like it. So let's go straight into the meat of the podcast, and let's talk goblins. Goblins was the first spin-off tie-in book for The X-Files. It was published on October the 28th, 1994, so when the show was in quite its infancy. It was written by Charles Grant, and the story sees Mulder and Scully investigating a small-town community when a mysterious group of deaths seem to have been caused by a possibly invisible assailant. Now, that is quite a brief synopsis of the book, isn't it, Sarah? It's a very, very basic synopsis of the book. But I think what we'll say is from the outset, okay, like we do with the episodes, this isn't going to be spoiler free, okay? We're going to talk about the book, we're going to talk about the characters, we're going to talk about the story. So if you haven't read Goblins and you want to experience it firsthand and then you want to come back and listen to this, that's probably a good idea, actually. So your mission...
Spoiler alert.
Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to go read Goblins and then come back. So, hello everybody, you've just read Goblins. Welcome back.
How do you feel?
How do you feel after reading Goblins? You've done that very fast. So out of 10, Sarah, on the book scale, and obviously this is new to the X-Cast, normally we do episodes, but out of 10, we're going to stick with this. Out of 10, what would you give Goblins?
Well, I was thinking about this really hard, and I think I'm going to have to separate story from the rest of it, story and writing. So as far as the story goes, I would have to say probably like 7 or 8.
Okay.
Because I really liked the story. But as far as the writing and characters and all of that sort of goes, I'd probably have to say like a 5 or a 6.
Let's separate this then a little bit. So a 7 and 8 for the story. Why would you give it a 7 or 8 for the story?
I felt like it really sort of stuck with, you know, the X-Files Monster of the Week style episode. You know, like it felt like a real episode that you would watch. Just sort of boiled down a little bit. And it actually reminded me a lot of Detour in a few ways with, you know, the creepy camouflage people. And
yeah.
You know, so it felt X-Files-ish, the story. And I liked that they worked in a little bit of government conspiracy with it too. And these fun, you know, creepy, weird experiments. So as far as that goes, you know, I really liked that part of it.
I think I'm gonna give it a 7. I'd say for story, I'll do the same as you. I'll separate the two. I would give it a 7. I think 6.5 to a 7, because I think it does have a nice little blend. You're absolutely right. I think when you say it's mostly Monster of the Week, but it does have that little element of conspiracy with the Timmons project and the stuff going on at the Air Force base, and that obviously comes into it more towards the end. Or towards the second half of the book. It's got that flavour of an X-File, and it does have moments in it that are, I would say, the kind of things you could visualise. Because the whole point of a tie-in book is that it tries to capture the tone of whatever it's tying into, doesn't it, really? So,
right.
You know, you want to be able to read it and think, I'm imagining an X-File on screen. And you know, it does do that when it's actually getting into the story. I do think, yeah, it does do that. I think it's elsewhere when it kind of falters. So that's why it's interesting you give it lower for the writing. So you said about 5 or a 6. What is it about that then that you would mark down?
Mostly, you know, when we're with the X-Files, generally the format of the episode is to stick with either Mulder or Scully and see the story from their perspectives. And I felt like, you know, with a few, you know, with the cold open, you know, you get the murder and all that, which I really liked in the book. They did that similar, you know, kind of thing and with the first chapter. And I did like that aspect of it. But then in the book, you know, you meet all of these characters. And first of all, there's so many characters. I'm terrible about remembering names. And a lot of the names were really similar. Like I kept getting Timmons and what's that other guy?
Is it Tenero?
Yes, Timmons and Tenero. I couldn't keep them straight. And Ellie and Elkhart, and there were just a lot of similar sounding names that I had trouble keeping up with. And they kept changing perspectives and points of view to everybody. And I think I would have rather had it stuck with Mulder and Scully and maybe, you know, the researchers.
Yeah, maybe Carl Borelli, the journalist. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Just like I would have liked to have had it, you know, just toned down a little bit and not get so many perspectives, because I think the great thing about the show is, you know, just not knowing what's out there in the dark and not, you know, typically getting that perspective makes it even more scary. And so I would have liked to have known less about what was going on in secret and had Mulder and Scully figure it out and sort of been along on the ride with them. And yeah. I think there was just too much going on.
They do keep back the reveal of what or who the killer is until very much towards the end. But it's around probably about three quarters of the way in that Mulder and Scully, and to be fair, they both kind of figure it out, which I quite like in this. It's not just Mulder making the big leap. Scully's kind of taken a leap and then Mulder pushes it a bit further forward, which I liked. Mm-hmm. But it's around three quarters of the way through where they realise that they're dealing with a chameleon. And but all the way through the book, at first when I read it, and I read this without any knowledge of the story, and I didn't know. I'd read it years ago when I was a kid, but I don't think I'd finished it because I wasn't particularly enjoying it. So when I bought it again for this, I thought, right, I'm going to start again. I don't know anything about the story. There's not much online either that gives you much about this as well. So I didn't know what was going to happen. And at the beginning, when you see, I think it's when Grady Pierce is killed at the cold open, as you said, it said that the killer's arm is described like bark. And at first I thought, oh, are we dealing with some sort of tree monster thing? Or are we dealing with... I don't know if you thought that. I thought, you know...
Yeah.
But obviously now, as we know, it's a chameleon and it's a military project. It's obviously blended in near a tree and so it looks like a bark. So at first, there is that nice little mystery. But then, yeah, as you go on through Rosemary Elkhart, who's involved with the project, and Major Tenero, who's the, you know, the overseer of this military project, you do start to see a little bit too much. And it's in, I remember when we were talking about, as we were reading the book, you know, we were messaging each other, and you said at one point, because you were reading this on Kindle, weren't you, or something like that, or an ebook, and they hadn't properly formatted the transitions between scenes, so you were really confused at one point, weren't you, about how the perspective.
Yeah, because I was in Mulder's head, and then all of a sudden it just, literally from one paragraph to the next, it changed perspective, so that took a lot of getting used to, and I had to struggle a lot trying to get through it because of that formatting issue. I mean, that's not a writing problem, that's a formatting problem, but it made it really difficult to get through because it, you know, and towards the end when everything gets more exciting, they switch faster and back and forth and back and forth. And that got really tough to get through. I think there was one part where it switches back and forth from Scully to Elkhart really fast. And there's just like there was one little paragraph in there that was Elkhart and then it went back to Scully. And it really threw me off, especially because they do it in a way where it's trying to be suspenseful. And if I had the page breaks and I could see, you know, like, hey, this is, something's going on here, I think it would have worked a lot better. Mm. But, it literally just cuts off like one scene from the next. And then you pick up this whole other scene. And it really took me out of the book.
Yeah.
Trying to figure all that out and keep up with it. So that was tough.
As somebody who writes, would you say that it's more of a hindrance or a help if you do switch perspectives like this? Because I think that the whole idea, like you said, it was about pace, wasn't it? I think Charles Grant wanted to keep the story moving and try and keep a sense of pace to it. When he did have quite a myriad amount of characters, you know, he wasn't just dealing with Mulder and Scully and maybe Carl or whatever. He does perspectives for probably about towards nearly a dozen characters, I would say, in this. Or maybe, he does it quite a few characters.
Yeah.
And there are certain points where Mulder and Scully aren't the perspective for a while, and you think, well, this is odd because it does feel more like an overall tapestry when the X-Files does always usually come through Mulder and Scully's prism. So do you think that it works better to create something with pace, and did it work with those perspective changes?
I think it would have worked much better had it been fewer characters. If he'd have picked at most, you know, Mulder and Scully plus maybe three others, just the main ones. Maybe Mulder and Scully and the reporter, one of the other FBI agents that was with them, and maybe one of the research scientists, I think, or the military, I think would have been a lot better. Because then you could have been everywhere you needed to be, but still get that. And I think, you know, when what is it, Leisha? She turned out to be somebody else. That came as quite a surprise. I think it would have been interesting to see, you know, her point of view and what her orders were. But you never got that out of all the people. you know, or maybe you just got like her. I think my problem was that it wasn't that there were so many people. It was that he only picked and chose here and there, and it was so spotty, and you never know who you were going to get, that I would have liked it to be more predictable and reveal more of the story that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. I do agree. And I think the whole Licia thing was meant as a surprise twist, but it just didn't work at all.
It was
very much a, hang on. There had been clues that she wasn't quite, you know, on the level, and there was something amiss with her. But for her to suddenly turn around and be like working for this project was like, well, wait a minute.
That threw me too. I was like, I'm not with you on that one. But
because for a minute I thought that she was going to be the goblin for a second. I was like, are they doing this so she? It's not going to be Maddie, and it's going to turn out to be Licia. And I was like, okay, I can just about go with that as a double twist, even though it's... But then for her to just be a rat... And the way she's killed as well, the way she's just... It's like, was it worth it? Was it actually worth it? So it's... Yeah, I think I'd probably give the writing about a 5.5 or a 6. So I think if I was to give it an overall grade, I think I'd probably have to go for about a 6.5, I think, as a whole. In that, I think... And I do know there are better X-Files books to come, actually. But I think it does do certain things right, and we'll get a little bit more into that as we go along. Just quickly though, before we talk, go into a bit more detail about the characters in the book and things like that. Let's talk a little bit about Charles Grant, because sadly he's no longer with us. Charles Grant, he died in 2006 of a heart attack when he was 64 years old, which is a real shame. But he wrote this book, and he did write Whirlwind, which is the next book we'll be looking at when we do the occasional book series of X-Files. And he, you know, he'd written a lot of other works with a lot of pseudonyms, you know, names like Deborah Lewis, Stephen Charles, Felicia Andrews, Simon Lake, Lionel Fenn, Jeffrey Marsh. He'd written a lot of horror novels. He wrote a lot of science fiction. Are you familiar at all with his work, Sarah?
I'm actually not.
No.
But just the X-Files books that I know of. I mean, you just listed all of those. Some of them kind of sound familiar, but there's a chance I probably have read them and didn't even realize that was him.
Yeah, he wrote a lot of stuff. I mean, he wrote a hell of a lot of short stories, quite a lot of novels, novellas, some nonfiction. So he was quite prolific, really. Mm. But he did only write two X-Files books, and then the rest were by various authors such as Kevin J. Anderson and various others after that. And then obviously we have the comic series, which are really the most prevalent now. We don't get as many books anymore, which is a shame, because I think it'd be great if we had more tie-in X-Files novels. We don't really get them particularly.
Right, yeah.
I don't know why. That's strange, really. You'd think they would. But it's a shame he's no longer with us. But he's obviously quite a prestigious writer in terms of horror. And I think that what they were going for was to try and start what I think they probably thought might be a bigger series of novels than they actually did in the end, with somebody who was a bit of a name in terms of that, you know, area. And as I say, I think he did do a good job in trying to get the tone of the X-Files. And bear in mind, he wrote this when the show was pretty new. You know, it had only been on air for about 6 months at the point he was starting to write it, because if this was first published in 1994, he was more than likely writing it during 1993.
That's pretty amazing, because they really didn't do that type of thing back then. Yeah. I mean, it's more now, but not then.
Yeah, exactly. So he would have probably maybe seen the odd episode, or he might not even have ever seen one. He might have just read scripts, or, you know. Uh-huh. So he was going off very, very limited material for this. Do you think that in terms of Mulder and Scully as characters, do you think that he captured both of them?
Yes. I would say he did a pretty good job with Mulder, and I would have liked to have more Scully. I felt like we didn't get enough of her. Yeah, I think especially in the very beginning, the first chapter, I remember noting that I was pretty impressed with Mulder's point of view when he was at the memorial. Just, you know, his sort of the inner workings of his mind and how he perceived Hank and and the other agents, and it felt true to me, to his character.
Mm.
And then Scully's, I liked how she sort of took care of him and after he had been injured, and hearing her inner dialogue was pretty, I felt, accurate. Yeah. It's pretty true to the characters. I mean, especially as true as he could be when it was not that far into the show.
Well, I think there might have been some like rewriting done up to the wire, because I don't know if you got this, but I very much got the sense that this was set after Scully had been abducted, because there was a reference, I'm sure there was a reference in this to the X-Files having been closed and reopened.
Yeah.
Early on. So I think this, that's why we're getting this episode out now, because as you're listening to this, if you're listening to this new, we're around towards the middle of season two. So that's roughly the area that I think this is supposed to be set. So if I was going to place this, and there is no official timeline actually for this,
uh-huh.
But if I was going to place, as far as I'm aware anyway, please feel free to correct me, guys, if there is. but as far as I think this is around Excelsis Day, Red Museum. That's where I would place this, relatively soon after Scully's returned from the abduction. Not that there's any mention made of it, but I think that there was a little bit of writing to put in that, because remember aired on October 28th, so that would roughly have been around the point that Scully was, all that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's when this was published.
I was thinking it was more towards the end of season two, like right season two, season three.
Do you think so?
Because do they close the X-Files after, you know, Paperclip? And but I guess if the book came out when it did, it would have had, you probably are more right than I am.
Well, I don't think they did close the X-Files at season three. I think it was that they were in jeopardy. But I don't, if I'm right, they don't close the X-Files again properly until the end, because they're closed during Fight the Future. So if I remember rightly, that's how it is. But yeah, I think roughly we're
you're right.
It's definitely season mm-hmm. two either way. I mean, I don't know if I'm right. I'm just guessing.
I think so. It makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, the point is that he's capturing a relatively early Mulder and Scully whenever he wrote it. I think I agree with you. I think more Scully would have been good, because it is, especially towards the first half of the book, it's very skewed towards Mulder's perspective, isn't it? And from the perspective we do see of either of them.
I would have liked to have had more interaction between them, I think. And because I think that's really what is one of the things I love most about the X-Files is their exchange and the way they go back and forth and work things out together. And I didn't feel like there was some of that in the books, but not enough.
No, there wasn't, was there? There was a lot of them either investigating people together or going off and doing separate things, mm-hmm. There wasn't that much of that banter or that back and forth. You get some of it towards the end, but there's not much. I agree there. And again, maybe that could have been because it was an early book and he hadn't quite nailed that down, Charles Grant, from what he'd seen, or I don't know. In terms of the what they do as characters, I didn't feel this was particularly a story which had much of an impact on them as people, really. I mean, the Mulder's having some strange dreams at various points, which I didn't really see the connection to the story with either all the time.
Yeah, I did like that scene where, you know, he had that nightmare and then it switched to Scully's point of view and she's like, I really hope Mulder's not dreaming. Like, yeah. Oh, you know him well. But as far as that goes, I felt like it was just thrown in there to sort of give a little bit of backstory for maybe people who hadn't seen the show, to sort of just set that up, which kind of was annoying because it never got revisited or anything like that. You know, it was just in there. But I always like to see angsty Mulder. That always makes me happy. He's depressed. He's, you know, going through his stuff with Samantha. And it made me mad that they had the different rooms, because it was like, you know, it would be a good opportunity for Scully to go comfort him.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And or maybe I've just been reading too much fan fiction.
And there's so much of it
that it can, right? It can, but there was some great stuff. Oh man, there's stuff that I still think about after all these years. Certain fan fictions, really good stuff. Yeah.
Well, I am hoping that we can, down the line, we can do an episode on some fan fiction, definitely. Or we can at least, you know, have a general couple of fan fiction episodes that talk more about it, because I think, yeah, there is some really good stuff out there. And like I said earlier, there aren't that many tie-in books. So, you know, to have this kind of fan fiction stuff is great, really. And it gets, and because it's fan fiction, you can do anything with it, you know. The thing with tie-in books is, and this is something that's quite clear with Goblins, is that it's operating within a box, isn't it? It's operating within a certain level of parameters. You know, there are only certain things that Charles Grant can do. You know, he can reference Samantha, or he can hint at that and at, you know, Mulder's quest, but he can't really do a lot with it, especially not at the point the show's on air.
I wonder if he was writing this, nobody knew that Gillian Anderson was pregnant, so they didn't know that she was going to get abducted on the show. Mm. So I wonder if it happened between the end of season one, when the X-Files were closed, and then... because they had to write that in. They didn't know.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, because given the point this was published, he had to have been writing it earlier in 1994 or 1993. So, yeah, I think you're right. And so they had to roll with certain things. And, you know, there were, like, you know, a good example of tie-in books that actually do manage to have an impact is the Star Trek tie-in books after the shows and the movies have ended, because they can actually continue the story. There's no, you know, they're not encumbered by having to do things, you know, dance around stuff that's on TV or movies. Whereas the X-Files, for the books we have, they have to do that. There is only a certain area they can play in. So
yeah, that's a big challenge. I would not want to be faced with that challenge.
It is difficult, because you've got to kind of create something that fits within that world, but still gives you some latitude to be a bit creative and to do something new.
Exactly. Yeah. To tell a new story, but try to fit it within. Yeah. That's tough.
Yeah.
And one thing that I really did like and enjoy was the mood and the atmosphere that he created with his descriptions and all of that. I felt that was really in line with the show, and just, you know, with the coming storm and all of that was sort of, and, you know, the deserted town, all of those descriptions I felt really added to the mood of the story and made it really X-Files-ish.
It's quite ominous, isn't it? You know, it does have a certain ominous element to the town.
It's funny, where I'm from in Tennessee, there's a town that's spelled Marvillele.
Ah.
But from being southern, everybody calls it, who's not from our area, calls it Maryville, but in our area, local dialect is Marvel.
No way.
So that's how we pronounce it. Yeah, so that it kept reminding me of that. It's like, oh, it's Marvel, but not.
Yeah, the town is called Marvel, and it is very... It is that very kind of small, that almost cliche small town American, you know, area that has nothing right there. You know, it's empty. It's a bit lifeless. The people there are quite, you know, they have no aspiration.
All up in everybody's business.
Yeah. Everybody knows each other, don't they, in this town? So, and that's something that's referenced quite a bit, you know, with characters like Babs, the whore in the hotel.
One thing that I found really curious was everybody knew everything about everybody else, but they were still running this secret, super secret project that nobody knew anything about. Like, I mean, really?
Yeah.
You're supposed to believe that nobody knew what was going on. Yeah,
nobody
figured. I guess
Ellie
kind of did, but yeah. Nobody believed her because she's calling a goblin.
Yeah. Because that was the character of Ellie Lang, wasn't it? The old lady who...
I liked her a lot.
She was good. She was good, because she was the one who basically, when Mulder and Scully and the other agents, who we'll talk about in a minute, they get there, she starts, you know, everyone saying, oh, you know, there's the old lady who has all the legends. It reminded me, have you seen the Blair Witch Project?
Yes. Of course I have. Sarah,
of course,
Blair,
you have.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I am the Blair Witch.
I'm glad you made that joke, so I didn't have to. but yeah, in... if you remember at the start of the Blair Witch Project, when they're going around Burkittsville and they're asking all the townspeople things, there's the old lady who they go and speak to, who tells them all about the old legend of the Blair Witch. Do you remember? And it's and she reminded me, I know this was before the Blair Witch, but she reminded me of that.
Well, isn't that kind of a typical character to have in these types of stories? I mean, the little lady who's everybody thinks is crazy, but she's the one that ends up right about everything.
Yeah, she's the one who has an inkling into what's going on. And obviously, in this case, she provides the book title Goblins, and it's anyone going into this would probably know that the goblins aren't actually goblins.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're not the mythical creatures from, you know, fantasy and folklore. But it's a nice little... I like that being the sort of catch-all name for the chameleon, actually, the goblin. Because it is that kind of urban mythical name, isn't it, that you would give to a monster.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it fits, you know, with the little town and... having this local creature. I've been listening to that podcast Lore quite a bit too, and you know, all these myths and legends seem to center around the small town, you know, with not much going on. Everybody's all trying to nose around and creepy stuff happens.
It's true. Did you know that they were doing a Lore TV show?
I do, and guess who is the showrunner?
Glenn Morgan.
That's right. I'm so jealous. This is my dream right there. All set up in a nice little package.
My only worry is that it will mean he doesn't write season 11. That's my only worry, because if he's busy doing Lore, he may have to turn season 11 down. That makes me think that maybe James Wong might not come back either. So I am a bit worried about that. But we'll wait and see. We haven't got season 11 confirmed yet, unless, because this isn't going out for a month, for 3 weeks. So maybe by the time you're listening to this, guys, season 11 will be a thing. But because
that's the case.
I know. And Simon keeps teasing us on Twitter. But so I'm sure at some point we will get the announcement. But keep your fingers
crossed. The great thing about Amazon and Netflix and the streaming services is they don't have to adhere to the same schedule as network television. So hopefully he can work it all in.
Yeah, maybe. Fingers crossed. Yeah. I like the optimism, Sarah. That's good. Let's keep that going.
That's what I'm hoping for. Let's cross our fingers that it'll all work out and we can have our season 11. Yeah.
I think it will. But yeah, she is a good character, Ellie. I mean, it does have some good. I did quite like quite a few of the supporting characters. I wasn't so keen on the project guys, but I liked characters like Hank Weber, who was the other FBI agent who at the beginning is the one who is kind of assigned with Mulder and then Scully to go and investigate this, along with Lysia Andrews, who we briefly talked about, who is the turncoat at the end. She's a bit rubbish, but Hank. Hank's good.
One thing that bothered me about Hank, and I had trouble with this, and it's probably because they kept switching perspectives. Occasionally they would say the redhead FBI agent. I'm like, well, who are they talking about? Is it Scully or is it Hank? Because they were both redheads. And that got a little bit confusing on a couple of parts for me. I was like, well, who, what?
You're right, actually. That wasn't clearly put across, was it, really?
Yeah, so, I mean, after I read, you know, a little bit past it, it would become clear. But on initial, it was just one more thing that took me out of the book. The best thing about... you know, reading these kinds of books and any book really is just getting lost in the story and not having to come back to your own world and just to be able to be in that world with the characters and the atmosphere around you and all that.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't want anything to, like you say, pull you out of it or make you go, oh, that's weird or that doesn't work. No, it's true. I think Hank as a character though was nicely put across. You know, he was almost like the if Krycek hadn't been a bad guy and he'd just carried on being green, he would have been Hank Weber.
I think so. Or the one that my mind just went blank. The other redhead that Scully kind of had a crush on and he ended up dying.
Oh, so. Agent Pendrell.
Yes, Pendrell. Yeah. He was Pendrell.
Pendrell had a crush on Scully, didn't he? Yeah.
He was so sweet.
He was a good guy, and all the good guys die in this show. We're gonna be crying some tears when we get to season 4.
Spoiler alert!
And Pendrell dies because Pendrell's lovely. He's a great guy, but yeah, he is a bit like Pendrell. You're right, and he's got that. You know, he's a bit in awe of Mulder. You know, and he's excited because he's on his first case out of the office, and everyone basically spends the entire book going, "Oh, dude, you know, just
chill out.
Just chill out, mate. You know,
sit down. Yeah. Breathe. Yeah. Take a breath.
Yeah.
And then at the end, when he's like, we're all going to die. She's going to kill all of us.
Yeah. They're like, mate, you're supposed to be an FBI agent. Just chill.
Be me. That would totally be me. I just like put my head down and be like, I can't deal with this right now.
But he's good, isn't he? In the sense that you would get agents or new agents who would act like that, you know, and who would be scared. And you know, he's a good contrast in the end to obviously Andrews, who is, you know, an evil, you know, villainess effectively. But it's he's a much more realistic character, except maybe for the fact that he's not a bad guy, but he has been stupid and he has been feeding information back to the boss at the FBI. And I thought that was very strange, because at the beginning there was a concerted effort to set up this character of Arlen Douglas as being like a Skinner replacement, because obviously Skinner doesn't feature in this. And sadly. And why? I mean, it almost seemed a bit pointless, because Douglas appears like once and he's set up as their new boss, basically. Uh-huh. And you think, well, what was the whole... I mean, okay, the whole idea is that Andrews is in the FBI and someone got her in the FBI to be... But you didn't need any of that. You could have just had Skinner give them this assignment like normal. You could have just got rid... And Hank could have just been a scared agent who...
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You didn't even need the Andrews twist either, because there were enough people out there trying to kill you.
Right. As if there weren't enough trying to kill. Let's just add a few more here.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Yeah. And what was the part at the very beginning with the mysterious person that kicked him? Was that, I mean, what was that about? It would have been nice if it was Andrews, like, you know, watch your back. And it was like the same, because he got kicked the same way, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he kind of got beat up the same way. And from the, when he was in the woods.
Isn't that what? Though at the end, isn't that what Maddie says to Mulder? Watch your back. I told you to watch your back. So is the suggestion that it was Maddie who did this?
I don't know. I think maybe, but it wasn't clear enough. Mm, I don't know.
It wasn't, was it? And because at the end, I was thinking, why would she tip Mulder off or do that?
But it was related to that case in Louisiana, right? Like that was a weird thing that got pulled in.
Yeah, that was the case the circus, wasn't it? The circus guy who vanishes in thin air?
But that was a guy, supposedly. So is that to imply that there are more out there?
It could be. Or I did wonder, maybe it was just the connective of being somebody who vanishes is part of what gets molded to the idea that this is a chameleon who can disappear, who can blend. I don't know. Again, like you say, if we're having to ask these questions, the book hasn't done its job right. And I mean, on the one hand, I mean, I suppose you could look at it from a different perspective of the X-Files is all about setting up questions that don't fully get answered, you know. Uh-huh. And in that sense, there are elements of this that you are questioning at the end going, oh, okay, well, that's it. But these questions, I think there's a difference. Let you know, at the end of Quagmire, when Big Blue appears, just to use that, you're going, oh, cool. Does that mean Big Blue's out there? Does that mean that Big Blue, you know, that's a cool little one. These questions are more like, well, that doesn't work for the story, does it?
Yeah.
Exactly. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I think basically he had a lot that he had to try to work in and deal with, and it just wasn't set up properly. I think it was a great attempt, and there was a lot that was working for it, but the things that weren't just sort of took you out of it too much.
Well, I think a good example of the things that didn't work, as we talked about earlier, were the project guys, like Tenero and Rosemary. I mean, what did you think of those guys? Because they had that kind of, they had a sexual relationship, didn't they? But then it turned out that Rosemary Alcott was kind of manipulating Tenero. And what did you think of those two?
I kind of almost felt like they didn't add much to the story. As far as their point, as far like their purpose was to be the bad guys and the antagonists and to, you know, have all this. But I felt like being inside their heads really didn't make the story better, I guess, and didn't really add much, a whole lot of suspense that we couldn't have gotten elsewhere, if that makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Because when I write, I try to, you know, make everything have a purpose. And if I'm telling it from a certain point of view, it needs to be that way for a reason. Like I told my book is from my main character, Sydney's point of view exclusively. And there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that I know about. And then I had to try to work in through other characters and what they say. But it's all being from her point of view, you can only get so much. And so I had to be careful about how I revealed things and that sort of thing. And then, you know, in my second book, I'm adding in another character's point of view, and it opens up a whole lot of stuff that the reader is going to get that they didn't know before, because, you know, being told from. So I feel like in this particular book, if he was going to have something happen from a certain character's point of view, it needed to be for a purpose to reveal certain information that nobody else could get. And I feel like, you know, with the scientists, what was the point of having all of that revealed that they couldn't have gotten elsewhere? Like, you know, I think they could have discovered, you know, Mulder and Scully could have discovered that through a different means or, you know, it just, and, you know, the having the romantic relationship between the two people or any of that, it just didn't really serve the overall story.
And it's like you said earlier as well, it kind of makes them a little bit less mysterious, you know, and it takes away that element of, okay, these guys were involved in this secret project to, you know, breed a chameleon, you know, to change the genetic makeup of a human being so they can willfully turn themselves into a chameleon and be the silent shadow, you know, lurking in the night. And that's a really nice idea, and it's quite a good idea. I don't think, I mean, yeah, okay, you had Detour, like you mentioned earlier, there's a similarity, but they didn't do anything specifically about chameleons really a lot in the X-Files. So it was a story that you didn't get in the show, but in the show, like you said, you wouldn't have got into those guys as much as you do, as they do, as Charles Grant does here. And I think, it does take something away from that enigma. And maybe by the end, we maybe know a little bit too much.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make it quite as... It's the fun part about reading a mystery is trying to figure it out, not to be told what's going on. I mean, they kept the chameleon kind of a secret. I mean, it was kind of creepy, you know, when Elkhart was in the elevator talking to the goblin, but I didn't feel like that could... I mean, that could have happened elsewhere. Yeah. With different people, even Borelli before he, you know, things like that could have been revealed through different characters.
Well, it's funny you should mention Borelli, because he's the other major character for a fair bit of the story, who is obviously Mulder's old friend, who is another one of those characters who has a crush on Scully, and he's a little bit sleazy, isn't he? He's a bit sleazy.
A little bit handsy. A little bit handsy.
And Scully is, you know, she's on, she knows. She's like, no, mate, it's not happening. But he doesn't do much, does he? He mainly just sort of flirts a bit with Babs, has the odd conversation with Ellie Lang, and then he's toast, you know, and you think, well.
I think he could have been put to much better use. And the whole thing where it was like his cousin's sister's fiance or something, I felt like that connection was just a little bit too far for me to get into.
I think Charles Grant seemed to try and work hard to get Mulder and Scully onto this from a different perspective, from a different way, when he probably could have done it a little bit more straightforward and it would have been fine, really.
Right.
And so, you know, from that perspective, I like that. And, you know, I like some of the sequences that he puts together. You know, he does create some quite creepy moments. You know, the whole stuff of Mulder in the woods, Scully in the shower when the goblin is there.
That was great.
That was really good, you know. And
that was really creepy.
She has to stalk around a motel room, afraid something's literally there and she can't see it. And the very final chapter where at the end Mulder's theorizing about how, you know, what if one day there could be an army of these things slinking through the shadows. Or that great moment when he thinks there could be someone in my bedroom right now.
Right.
And I could be stabbed and I wouldn't know it. That's a great fear. That's a great human fear about, you know, not being able to see what's there. So stuff like that's really good. It's just the character things don't always back it up, do they?
It was funny. I was going to mention I call it a cold open scene, you know, the first chapter of the book, the prologue, I guess it would be, you know, with the original murder. I was reading that in the dark, as I usually do in the middle of the night after my kids go to bed. That's why I have to read on my Kindle, because if I read an actual book, my kids just yank it away. And it's like, hey, Mom, what's this? Well, I'm trying to actually read that, but, you know. And I don't want to be like, you know, don't look at books, because that would, you know. Yeah, so it was the middle of the night, and I had the baby monitor right next to my head, and I was reading, you know, the cold open, and the guy gets murdered and slashed, and I was like, oh, I was like so into it, and the baby screamed, and I was like, ah! I jumped about 3 feet out of bed, completely levitated, so terrified. So that happened.
That just shows it's doing its job, right?
Yeah. I mean, the beginning was, I was really super into it at the beginning. Yeah. So there were things that were definitely working and doing what they were supposed to do.
And I think, you know, to wrap up, I think that's the message of Goblins, really. I think it's got a good idea at the center of it. It's got some evocative moments that Charles Grant puts out there. But I think there are a few story and definitely a few character problems along the way, really, that prevent this being a really, really great tie-in book. But I think I don't know if it's going to win over people who are just casual X-Files fans, but I think anyone who's an X-Files fan would get something out of this, don't you?
I agree. Yeah, I totally agree. And I feel like if it just didn't have so much trying to happen, I think it could have been simplified a lot and it would have been a lot stronger for it.
Yeah, I agree. If you've listened to this and you haven't read Goblins, A, sorry. B, why?
We gave you a spoiler alert.
we did give you a spoiler alert. But Goblins is now is available on Amazon. It's not really massively in print anymore, I don't think. You might find it in bookstores, but I think you might have to search from, you know, secondhand book vendors and things like that. But it is out there, and I got it off Amazon relatively cheap and pretty quickly, so you should be able to find it. And yeah, if you're an X-Files fan, it's worth picking up, really. Before we go, though, we're not going to put Sarah through a quiz, and she can breathe a big sigh of relief, because as we talked about before we started recording, I think she expected one. I thought instead we'd devote the time to talking a little bit about you and your book. Because as you mentioned at the start of the podcast, you do have a book out and you are a writer. So tell us a little bit about the book itself and then how you came to write it.
All right. Well, Darkness Shifting is my first book. It's my debut novel. And I got the idea when I had just been married and moved to a new town, and I got my degree in creative writing, so I thought, well, I've got a little bit of time on my hands and I, you know, don't have anything to do right now, so I might try to write a book. And I was just sitting there thinking, and this girl walked into my head and flashed a badge and said, what have we got? And I thought, I don't know, maybe, you know, I'd like to find out. And I knew there was a dead body, so I had to figure out why the body was dead and how I got there. And, you know, it just opened up this whole realm of possibilities that I was really excited to explore. And my main character is Sydney Lake, and she's a paranormal investigator. So the medical examiner finds the body and calls her in. She, the weird stuff is her jurisdiction, is what he likes to say. So cool. She handles the weird stuff and tries to find out what's going on and what's behind all the shadows and things that go bump in the dark.
Ooh, just like Mulder.
Yes.
So the X-Files is, I would assume, the biggest inspiration then for the adventures of Sydney Lake.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, watching the show and all of that really had a big impact on me, as, you know, just developmentally as a human being, and as far as the stories that I really enjoy telling and things like that, and just the craft of, you know, how to make things scary and how to keep people turning pages and keep watching, you know, that kind of thing. Just how to hook people and keep them interested. So that definitely had a huge influence on me. And as far as the paranormal and all of that, I've always been intrigued by ghosts and things that you can't see, that kind of thing. So the two and two together kind of really sealed the deal for me about what the types of things I like to write.
Yeah. So is this a one-off book, or is this the first in a series then?
It's the first in a series. I'm actually not entirely sure how many books are going to be in the series yet. Definitely one more, possibly another one after that, with maybe a novella in there somewhere, and hopefully an epic fantasy, but I'm really intimidated by that right now. So that's going to take some time and a lot of research, because that's going to be right. The Darkness Shifting, my book that I have out right now, is an urban fantasy. So it takes place in New York City, and it's got a lot of paranormal elements to it. But then the other book I have planned is within the same world that I've created, but it would be a historical fantasy. So it would take place in the first century AD.
Cool.
In England. So, yeah. Exciting. With the Romans in Britain. Yeah. That's going to take a lot of research.
Yeah.
Energy. Effort. Hoping to maybe tackle that after my kids get into school full time.
Well, I think the fact you've written one book is an achievement enough, because that's an epic in itself, to actually finish a book and to get it out there. So, you know, that's a huge achievement on its own. And I'm sure more will come, absolutely. Where can people get Darkness Shifting then? Where can people find it?
It's on Amazon, iTunes, Nook, everywhere ebooks are sold. You can get paperback copies off of Amazon and Barnes & Noble. So
buy it.
Yeah.
That's what you were trying to say. You were trying to be very nice and diplomatic about it. So I'm gonna take you at your misery. Buy it, everybody.
Yes. And exactly. I mean, I'm trying to get used to the fact that I have to peddle my own book and tell people to buy it. Like, I mean, I don't have, you know, I wrote the book I wanted to read. I love it. It's so much fun, and I still enjoy reading it, but I don't know, you know, it's still astonishing to me that anybody else would read it and enjoy it.
That's the thing. You wrote the book you wanted to read, and I think that's the key crucial thing, definitely. We're going to review Darkness. Sarah's been kind enough to give me a copy of the book, so we're going to review Darkness Shifting on the XCast blog at some point going forward. I think we'll start off the book corner with that one. I think that's an appropriate Excellent. Novel to start the book corner off. Yeah, we've got.
I would be really honored and flattered.
Oh no, it's the pleasure's mine. We've got Sam Turton's little film corner now, spooky film corner. Sam's spooky film corner, which is started. So she's writing film blog reviews there. So we need to get the book corner going, the spooky book corner. So I think this can be a good start. So we'll do that, definitely. So look out for that soon, guys. And definitely pick up Darkness Shifting. Yeah, support a new author launching a career. Yeah. And you know, if you like the X-Files, you're gonna love Darkness Shifting and Cindy Lake.
Then a few of my fans have described it as X-Files meets King Arthur. So there's paranormal and a little bit of Arthurian legend in there too, which was a lot of fun to work in. So, yeah.
What more do you want, guys? Seriously. I mean, come on. let's support Sarah and try and check that out, definitely. And as I say, keep an eye out on the blog for our review coming up soon. So yeah, thanks, Sarah. It's been really nice to talk to you about goblins and about your work. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
Oh, you're too kind. You're too kind. Where can people find you then online to find out more about the book and you?
Well, I'm on the XCast blog. I'm on Twitter at Sarah L. Blair, SARAHLBLAIR. And I'm also online at SarahLBlair.com and Facebook at Sarah L. Blair. So pretty much if you Google Sarah L. Blair, you'll probably be able to find me somewhere or another.
Yeah, get on it, guys. Yeah. Get on it. Keep track of Sarah as she starts writing book two as well. So you can find Sarah on the XCast blog, which you can find on WordPress. So if you just type in the XCast and WordPress, and you'll find our blog, and there'll be links floating around our Twitter and our Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at @X_cast, and on Facebook at @XCast. And we've got a lovely Facebook community there talking about the X-Files every day, lots of articles going up, posts, things like that. So check them all out, and keep listening for more X-Cast episodes as we delve into season 2 continually, and we get more interviews. We've got some more interviews coming up with different people, and we will be doing the books again. We will be doing more books, definitely, and Sarah will be back at some point on the show. So
can't wait.
Yes.
Gotta take that quiz.
Oh yeah, you've got to face the X.
I'm determined to ace it. I don't know, we'll see.
You need to get 5. Six. Yeah. There's only one or two people have done it so far, so you need to become part of the elite, Sarah.
So exactly. It's my goal in life. if I don't get at least, 6 out of 6, I'll fail as an X-File.
This is it. Mm. It's no pressure.
My whole life has been leading to this moment.
get revising. Yeah, until Sarah comes back and we come back for a new episode. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, as always, trust no one.